My name is Joshua Gibson, and you are listening to the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast, a show dedicated to promoting a message of critical thinking as it pertains to strength training, nutrition, and well-being. This is done through interviews with experts, high-level athletes, coaches, and people heavily involved in strength sports and athletic development. Pull up a chair, grab a coffee, and let's get on to today's podcast. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast. My name is Joshua Gibson. I am your host, and I'm joined today by a very special guest, and I feel like I say that entirely too often, but it usually is the case. And it is special this time specifically because of the organization of the podcast. If you're a longtime listener, you've realized that we often have on researchers, coaches, athletes, people who are probably experts in nutrition, sport performance, etc. But we actually have not had on anyone who's specialized in the psychological component of sport performance. And luckily for us, we have on Hugh Gilmore, who is a sports psychologist and also at one point in time worked with British Weightlifting, has done a lot of work in weightlifting himself, and is very learned in the sport. So I'm really excited to have an episode where we're able to bridge theory to practice. And just as a quick plug for my buddy Seb over at Weightlifting House, they have an athletes only event coming up in September. I want to say it's September 25th. I could be wrong, but it's somewhere in September. And Hugh will actually be speaking at that event and covering, I believe it's habit formation and how you can help yourself develop better habits for supporting sports and supporting a lifestyle that's conducive to improving sport performance. And if I've said anything wrong there, Hugh, you can correct me. Seb, if you're listening, you can correct me. But that's my understanding of it. And without droning on, Hugh, how's your day been so far? You're a few hours ahead of me.
Yeah, it's about 3:30 at the moment, and my day's been pretty good so far. I've just been trying to get through things. It's a weird period of time because I currently working with British Weightlifting and with British Athletics, and the Olympics have just happened and the Paralympics are also on. So I've got this kind of, you know, the calm before the storm of the Paralympics starting, and yeah. I'm just excited to see what has happened. It's the culmination of, you know, 5 years of work for some of the guys I've worked with. And yeah, it's a nerve-wracking kind of time.
Having working with people who are competing, and I've never worked with someone competing at that high of a level, but I can only imagine kind of the pressure, but the anxiety, the excitement that comes along with it, just kind of seeing how it's going to play itself out, seeing if all of the work put in beforehand manifests itself in a record-setting performance, or, you know, maybe, you know, on the other end of the stick, sometimes a bomb out, just based on how things go. But knowing, you know, I kind of gave the brief introduction of you working with British Weightlifting and being involved with the sport of weightlifting for quite some time now. Maybe we can rewind a little bit just to give, you know, our listeners a little bit of a better picture of kind of how you started developing an interest maybe in sports psychology or the field of psychology kind of as a whole, and then how that ended up manifesting itself in the sport of weightlifting and kind of organizing itself so that you're working with Olympians.
Well, you know, when people often talk about how they got to where they are, and we listen to some nice big story, I think the best thing I heard about that is you might as well be showing your lottery ticket and saying, look, these are the numbers that worked for me. So like, in terms of like the trajectory that I've been through academically, I've done a sports science degree, went off, did a PGC, which you try to complete to become a primary school teacher, and failed that, and then decided I'm going to follow the dream and do a master's in sports psychology, and went off and did that because that's what I was most interested in, and ended up somehow making it work and getting a job working with Olympic and Paralympic athletes in the UK system. But I think to go back further, my interest in sport comes from the GAA, which is the Gaelic Athletic Association in Ireland, and I grew up in a small village playing hurling, which is a stick. It's a game played with a stick and a ball, kind of like lacrosse and field hockey. For any Americans listening, but look up hurling and you'll see what it's about. It's fast, and I was not really that good at it, but I was also not really fast either. And I once heard that Greg Glassman from CrossFit do a talk, and he said something about weightlifters were faster over 40 yards than sprinters. And that's when I sort of got the hook of like, right, I must learn about this weightlifting then. What's that all about? And that was at 27 when I couldn't even squat properly because my hamstrings were so tight. I had a pair of Dewin shoes, the old ones, and then I had an extra half inch stuck on top of the heel. That's how inflexible I was, you know. I might as well have been wearing stripper heels. But so I got into weightlifting, and that was around the time I went off and did my master's and ended up then getting involved with Go Lift Weightlifting Club in Northern Ireland, and then sitting on the committee for Weightlifting Northern Ireland as well, and getting involved in the coaching, because I was at that stage already involved in coaching within the GAA, within hurling, and had worked as a sport development officer. So I was wanting to get into weightlifting so I could get better at hurling, and ended up completely transitioning to another sport that I'm bad at. So that's been my background. But from a psychology perspective, I've always found the idea that our mind has an impact on our performance quite powerful. I've read a number of books about it, but there was an incident in university where one of my lecturers, they pulled three people out from the crowd, and I was one of them, and they handed out three envelopes, and they said, you've got 60 seconds, get into a position to do sit-ups, here are your instructions. And my instructions were do 30. And I thought, right, I've got to do 30 sit-ups in 60 seconds. And the other lad's instructions, one was do the best. The other one was do 60. And we all sat down to do, you know, these sit-ups, and the lecturer timed it. And this actually resulted in me doing 30. And the other two lads were flying. They were really pushing themselves. And I did my 30 and thought, right, I've done 30 and they're still going. And so I did like another five and then just sat there. And while they're busting themselves, and I kind of thought like, this is amazing. The instructions that I was given determined what I, you know, the goal that I was set determined what effort I put in. And I just remember thinking like, you know, this is kind of phenomenal in terms of like output, like how we think about the task that we're given can change how much effort we put into it. So that, again, that was one of the things that kind of hooked me on psychology. And ever since then, it's been a very interesting journey that I've definitely enjoyed.
Yeah. I don't know if a lot of people listening know this, but I actually, when I was making my way through kind of like undergrad and even a little bit before that, I had a pretty deep interest in philosophy and psychology. And, you know, now saying that out loud, it's like the podcast is Philosophical Weightlifting, kind of jokes on me because I said that. And it's like, yeah, I don't think people know that I had an interest in philosophy or psychology, but I actually have a minor in psychology, and I've always kind of had an interest in like neuroscience and in reading books from like Carl Jung and you know, famous psychologists and psychoanalysts and stuff like that. So I kind of share that, and you start to recognize the importance, because the mind, right, the central nervous system is kind of the manifestation of reality, and everything is an input and then created and then kind of developed as an output through that system, I guess. I don't know if that's a little too deep for the podcast, but so all of that to say that I can share that interest. And when you developed it initially, was it kind of further stoked as you had gone through your graduate level education? Is it something that kind of kept developing as an interest, specifically when you started to specialize in sports psychology?
You know, I think the big thing for me is that within the system that operates within the UK, I'm aware the American system's different. of how psychologists are trained in sports psychology. The academic side of things was interesting, but it was left a lot to be desired in terms of how you actually do applied psychology, and that's only come in later years. And there is an accreditation process you go through to get that bit. But again, even still, it's still lacking in my eyes. It's more so of a, okay, we can sign you off as you're not dangerous. And then after many years of, you know, failed attempts and some successes, you start to put together an idea of how to operate. But I think for me, the biggest things that have shaped how I've operated has been understanding rational emotive behavior therapy, which was created by Albert Ellis, and also getting trained up and becoming a trainer in motivational interviewing, which was created by Bill Miller and Steve Rolnick from Addictions Therapy. I think it's interesting you mentioned Carl Jung. You know, I've read a little bit of Carl Jung's writings, not an entire book by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, when we look at psychology in other fields, we find that sports psychology is based on a lot of the same ideas. You know, you've talked there about how the mind's eye kind of creates the reality for the person. And the original research in that was from Lazarus and Folkman, who talked about cognitive appraisals. And I often put up, when I'm teaching this, I do a few lectures from time to time for people and universities. And I put up a picture of like a cake. And some people see a cake and look at it as a challenge. And some people see a cake if you're dieting and look at it as a threat. And it's the same with a wolf. You know, you might see a wolf and think, Jesus, I don't want to get eaten by this wolf. But somebody else might look at it and go, oh, there's a wolf. I'm going to hunt that. You know, and it's the appraisal's based off of, do I have the skills to cope in this situation? And if you don't have the skills to cope, it then becomes a threat. But I mean, again, this emerged out of Lazarus and Folkman's work, working in a more clinical area, and it's adapted straight into sports psychology as, you know, threat appraisal. Am I viewing my training? Am I viewing my competition or my situation as a threat? And is that hampering the decisions I make and how I go about coping with the skills? And then how do I change that to make it applied? I'm going down a rabbit hole here, but to make it applied, what you would do is you'd ask yourself, what resources do you have to cope? How can you simplify the task? So if you're going out to compete, instead of saying, you know, get into a good start position, make sure you stay over the bar, make sure you finish the pull, whenever you catch it, drive straight up and make sure the weight's over the midfoot, you kind of go, that's too much to focus on before a competition. Simplify the task into just get into the start position. And that suddenly the task becomes doable because you know what to do after that and you've just made the task simple. All you have to do is go out onto the platform, get in the start position. So the other way then is to reduce the importance. So if you want to reduce somebody's anxiety in line with the cognitive or the reappraisal model from Lazarus and Folkman, you reduce the task demands, you increase the resources by drawing back on maybe their successes or on their recent training numbers or whatever they've done that would be a perceived resource. And then you reduce the importance of it and tell them, look, it's just a weightlifting competition. It's not your mortgage, you know? So yeah, sorry, I've just gone down a big rabbit hole there. Tried to link things together.
No, it's great. And again, I think off air, we talked a little bit about how this is more of a free-flowing kind of concept that we use here on the podcast. I don't know why I'm speaking like I have a whole team behind me, but it's more free-flowing. So when you're saying all this, my mind just connects a lot of different dots. And specifically, I was thinking about it in terms of skill acquisition. Mm. If you have someone who's trying to learn the snatch, and I had someone do this yesterday, they have so many movement options and 99% of them are going to be the most inefficient ways to do it just because they haven't either conceptually developed an understanding of the skill or they haven't figured out how to organize their sequence of movements or they don't even have like the gross motor abilities to organize that skill because of maybe some movement limitation up top or some inability to kind of like, you know, separate the movements of the knees with the movements of the hips with the movements of the shoulders and elbows and arms or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so you start instilling some sort of constraint and maybe you put a board in front of their feet and because they can't jump forward, they have to drive up a little bit more aggressively. And maybe you add in a pause so they can kind of slow things down. So again, you're really trying to remove as much of the noise as possible so you can really distill down the signal to something that's clear, concise, and understandable. And that's, I mean, that's kind of what you're saying with respect to these really difficult situations where there's a lot happening. It's like, okay, well, how can we kind of get our foot in the door, and how can we expose them to just enough that it gets them ready, but not overwhelm them? And and I've been using a kind of a little trick for me, and I tell this to people I coach before they go out for an attempt, or when we're prepping for a competition. It's think about one thing. And I usually, for myself, usually it's like, what do I tend not to do? And that's like finishing at the top. Like I tend to cut my pull short and I don't really get enough time up top, especially for the snatch. So I kind of like bump the bar out and pull it a little short. So I'm just like, okay, at the top, big finish. And I'll just repeat like one word or two words over and over and over. And for me, that almost like takes up enough of my attention so that I don't acknowledge as much the crowd, or I don't acknowledge as much what could happen if something goes wrong, or what I'm going to do if something goes right. But it just keeps me grounded in that one attempt. And you know, with more competition experience now, I can kind of enjoy myself and look around at the crowd and kind of take it in a bit more. And but that really kind of kept me centered for every attempt. It's just, what do we need to do to make one successful lift? And that's what I'm going to try to do. And that's kind of my mission. So I think there's a lot of great stuff there, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just to add in on that, what's really interesting is, like, I assume you can walk all right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Can you walk and chew gum?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you walk and chew gum and juggle?
I actually don't know.
Right. So what I've done is I've just slowly increased the task demands, and we've got to the point where you're like, whoa, this is now challenging. But walking's not challenging, because whenever you're walking, you can do all sorts of things. You can talk on the phone, you can shout abuse at somebody, you can tell a bad joke, whatever, you know, you can do loads of things when you're walking. And we think about this in weightlifting terms, is like, when you've got a skill that you've become automatic with, then you've got capacity to do other thinking. And one of the things with advanced weightlifters is that, okay, weightlifting, the skill of doing it has become easy. It's now just a repeating, you know, a relatively robust skill, and seeing how they develop their physiological systems that can bear and maintain the weight. And then they then can think about other things. And as you said, they can think about the crowd. And maybe that's okay, but maybe sometimes it's not. And this is where then in performance settings, a pre-performance routine comes in. Because what you want is you want to occupy yourself with enough stuff, like you've said, the coaching cue, so that you're focused in on the thing that's difficult, but it's not too difficult. And it doesn't allow you to be distracted. Because I think, like, if you think about it, if you were thinking about the wrong thing before a lift, before a max lift, you know, it's not going to be conducive to a good performance. So I think that's, I mean, it's just very rich what you've said there. I'm just throwing some psychology on top of the richness of your experience.
Well, and I was looking at an Instagram post from Mike Teixeira, the powerlifting coach, and he was saying that generally for people, their weak range of motion won't change. And I guess most people who are listening can think of this for a raw squatter, for someone who doesn't use a lot of support. It's typically right around parallel where the knees kind of get the furthest away from the barbell, the hips kind of get the furthest away from the barbell, and the force demands are really increased at those two joints to extend them back to get them right back under the bar where the weight is. And that generally won't change much. So you kind of try to just shore up that weak range of motion, but it's always going to just kind of sit behind just a little bit. And that's how I feel about, at least how I felt about my technique, is I can make my pull more efficient. I can do a lot of things well, and I can make my strong points a lot stronger, but it's always that little bit at the top that I'm kind of missing. So I know reliably when I miss kind of how I'm going to miss. And it kind of goes like one of two ways, and it just makes for, I think a more reliable kind of approach in competition, because I don't have these like fluke misses where, you know, suddenly I'm jumping forward or suddenly I'm jumping backwards or suddenly I'm doing something that's completely out of the ordinary. And I think that it sets you up to plan and then to execute that plan a little bit better and to kind of, again, comes back to distilling down and creating a more like concentrated approach to what could be considered like a novel problem of competing in a really nerve-wracking situation. Maybe we can take this a step further, because I've been weightlifting for a long time now, but our club, Clintonville Barbell, is hosting a meet in September. It's going to be the first meet we've ever hosted, and we have a lot of first-time competitors. Specifically, my partner, she's going to be competing for the first time. And I know she's going to be very nervous, and she's never really done anything like this before, where she's kind of put herself in front of a crowd to perform a skill like a snatch and a clean and jerk. What's your advice or kind of your spiel to people who are green, like completely green or very new to something like that, where it's almost the most exaggerated response you can get, because you kind of live in a place this day and age where there's not a lot of kind of putting yourself out there into these incredibly enriching, but also incredibly anxiety producing situations, like performing a complex skill in front of a large group of people you've never met before, who you have no relationship with, in a place you're unfamiliar with, you know, kind of lifting on someone else's clock under someone else's set of rules. How do you generally advise people who are new to that type of thing?
I suppose my first instance would be, if it's your first competition, I don't know what's worse. Is it the ridiculously tight singlet you have to wear? or is it everybody looking at you and you trying to lift something? I think from that point of view, like, I think the approach I would look to create is, like, it's the coach's job to make you hungry for a little bit more. And, you know, this is why the first attempt should be something that is, like, it's not challenging. It's like nearly even to an extent boring, so that, you know, 99% of the time it's a dead cert that they're going to get that lift, and then from that you go up a bit, and then maybe in the last attempt you would let them go for something a little bit wilder if they wanted it. But I think for me, it's like, as a coach, if you want them to have a good experience, plan for success from that point of view, and make it like, you know, there's nothing riding on it other than your own enjoyment. So make it enjoyable. And maybe if you need to reduce anxiety, make the first attempt boring. That would be my approach for doing something safe. I mean, does it really matter what you get in your first competition? It matters more so what you get in your last competition, but before you retire, when you think, well, this has been an interesting journey of weightlifting. So I think from that point of view, I would just say, you know, go out and enjoy it that way, and let the coach sort of contain the nerves. But I mean, the other thing is, if I was going to go into this in a big way from a psych perspective, I'd look at it from a rational emotive behavior therapy viewpoint. And that essentially states there's four different ways that I can change how somebody, you know, copes with a situation. And I want you to think of these as four levels. Level one is, I change the situation. So if you're anxious about lifting the weight, you change the weight. Or if you're anxious about lifting in front of people, you don't do it in front of people. Or if it's just wearing the singlet in front of people and the weight at this venue, then you don't go. And then suddenly you feel better about it. So that's like, change the situation. Now, it'll stop you feeling, you know, a bit challenged by it, but or anxious, but it doesn't actually develop you as a human. But there are situations where you don't have to, you know, you can just change the situation, and that's fine to do that. The next level up is the behavioral level of change of, right, I need to teach you some skill. I need to teach you a behavior that allows you to cope better. And if you're quite anxious and you're having physical symptoms of anxiety, I'd say, like, you know, do some breathing, calm down in the warm-up area to sort of bring yourself down from the edge. Or if you're not
up for it enough, you know, think some nasty thoughts or things that are going to get you fired up for why you're excited. If you need to, so it would be like learn a behavioral skill to change how you self-regulate in terms of your physical symptoms. And then the next level up is the cognitive side of things, how you cognitively or what you think about. And you might be thinking, if this goes wrong, I'll look silly. And like, well, what does that mean? Will you look silly to? Will you look silly to yourself? Why are you not allowed to make a mistake? And what evidence do you have that other people are there to hate you and think that you are a silly person who does silly things and will fail in silly ways? So when we ask those questions, that thought sort of pattern starts to disappear. So you can challenge the cognitive thoughts. The last level of change, which is the most powerful one, but the most difficult one, is the philosophical level of change, where we would ask the question, let's assume that for this competition, it's going to go badly. How do you want to approach that? Do you want to be somebody who doesn't try, or do you want to be somebody who tries and fails? And when that's a philosophical change, because we now have created the worst scenario and we've asked you to cope in that. And you find very quickly that somebody says, well, no, I should try. This is important to me and I want to try. And even if it goes badly, it's worth doing. Well, then suddenly the anxiety, the stress, the pressure starts to feel a little bit less when you can think of it in that terms.
I don't quite remember where I heard the story, but it's kind of coming off of that last point you made. Someone was advising an athlete and they were saying, okay, well, if the worst thing happens, if you get injured, like what's your plan? Like, what are you going to do to take care of that? And how are you going to start the rehabilitation process? And it turns out that the athlete actually did experience an injury. And I guess they were comforted by the fact that they knew what to do after it happened. And they were able to make decisions and kind of act on those.
Mm-hmm. You know, it actually sounds like a story I've told on a podcast that you mentioned, I believe.
Oh, that might be it.
Beforehand. So a perfect example of, I worked with an athlete who was a 400 meter runner from Romania. And he was competing in the World Masters. And he was a professional athlete up until the age of 27 and then retired into the Masters at 35 and wanted to work with me. And basically was afraid of hamstrings going whenever he put spikes on. And the idea being that, right, that means more force. That means more oomph when you're running, therefore more likelihood of injury. So he's always afraid of spikes. And, you know, as you should be, because the more force you subject yourself to, if you haven't been prepared for it, your increased injury risk. I said, right, okay, if you get injured, what do we do at this competition before the World Masters competition? And he said, well, I would do this. I would, you know, I would ice it, I would rest it, I would then go see a physio, I would then do this rehab plan, which worked for me last time I had that injury. And, you know, we laid out, like, what do the 2 weeks look like if you've got injured the first 2 weeks after an injury? And he said, when his hamstring went, he was like, oh, shit. And then he was like, I know exactly what I have to do. And because he knew exactly what he had to do, he went through the protocol. I did everything perfectly and was still able to recover enough to put in a performance that he was happy with at the World Masters Championships. So, like, can you prepare for the worst? But look, we don't even need to that story to know that works. The research from Gabrielle Ottingen talks about, like, numerous different examples of how if we think about the worst thing that can happen and prepare for it, then we're more likely to be successful. And, you know, but again, Mike Tyson said it as well, didn't he? You know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. So your plan is, what do I do when I get punched in the face? Not, what's my plan before I get punched in the face?
I think that's an important point because, again, I feel like every conversation I'm either involved with or I listen to and sit in on, it always focuses on how we can maximize the positive result or how we can ensure a positive result or how we can manipulate the environment to create an environment conducive to, like, it's all working towards the best. Like, how can we make the best manifest itself? And I think that that like hypervigilance to make it become the best meet or the best training session or the best whatever, it kind of neglects exactly what you're talking about, where you have to almost face adversity before it happens to figure out how you're going to map it out and then cope with it. So I think that's actually very insightful. Like bringing up that point.
Think about it this way, right? I think the research will point to something like you need 2.4 lifts on average in the snatch and in the clean and jerk to be likelihood of winning a medal in the Olympics. So like the best competitors will have an average lift success of 2.4 in the snatch and 2.4 in the clean and jerk. So the idea being that, you know, what does that work out? 4.22. Maybe it's higher than that. Maybe, yeah. But anyway, the point being that there is mistakes. There's mistakes in the process because you're getting so close to the edge, and how you cope with them will allow you to adapt and still get the next lift. And, you know, to that end, putting pressure on situations in training is very useful. One of the things we used to do at Go Lift Weightlifting Club, the coach Pete Stewart, Pete, big shout out if you're listening, you're a very influential person, and thanks for everything you've done over the years. But one thing that he used to do was he'd say, right, pick your weight, you're going to hit it 10 times, and everybody would pick their weight, and they all had to see who could hit their weight 10 times in that session. In their attempts, and it was like a fun way to create pressure. But then very quickly it was like, oh well, he's missed one, and this person's missed one, and there was a competition then in the gym that occurred out of it. So you had kids competing with adults trying to do this, hit their weight 10 times successfully, and that's the kind of pressure you want to be creating. You want to create that so you can cope and adapt, and then learn how to refocus when you have a setback.
Yeah, I've never thought of that. And again, your point of, I think your point is very very pertinent, because you say, okay, the best, the people who are going to medal or the people who are going to do really well, still miss. Okay, so they obviously have to face that. It's kind of that same idea of when we're shown the injury rates within weightlifting or powerlifting, where it's like per this many participation hours, usually it's on the scale of like 1,000 participation hours, you're going to see 3 to 4 injuries or something like that, right? The idea being that if you do something long enough, you're going to undergo some sort of setback in the form of an injury, whatever that may be, however you define injury. Like, we can keep it as vague as possible, but still acknowledging the idea that something will happen and you're going to have to develop a plan to either work around it, work through it. Now, I guess on the back end of that, we know that these things will happen. It's kind of inevitable just based on probability of being involved with a sport where there's a chance of injury and then a chance of missing a lift in competition or a chance of not doing well. Are there certain lasting personality traits that, I guess a better question would be, are there personality styles or traits that are more resistant to handling those situations? And the reason I say this is because when you work with a wide swath of people, you see people who, again, view something more as a challenge and become more excited to do something and see, you know, even though I failed, I still competed or I still participated. And then some people who, no matter what happens, it seems like there's a bad end of the stick or a short end of the stick. It's like, I went 6 for 6, but it didn't look perfect. Or, yeah, I hit a PR, but, you know, there was a slight give in the elbow, therefore it wasn't a great, like, these things that persist kind of besides the situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So I'm not an expert on personality, and in fairness, I know very few people who are.
I have delivered some personality tests and seen behind the scenes of what goes into them. And, you know, even if you do something like the Big Five, which is the gold standard test, and not some Mickey Mouse, you know, what magic color are you type thing. There are personality tests out there that give people a bird. What type of bird are you? Are you a wise owl or a magical sparrow? But the thing is, in terms of the Big Five, you've got openness to new experience. You've got agreeableness, which is how agreeable you are to people, or disagreeable if you're the other end of the scale. You've got extroversion, introversion scale. You've got neuroticism, and you've got openness, agreeableness, conscientiousness. You know, those are all going to have an impact, but like, we can't change that. This reminds me of your personality does change over time, you know, as you age, and certain experiences will change your personality, but you can't change it. And it reminds me of a coach who was like an old dude at the weightlifting club and very well respected. And he turned around and said to one of the female lifters, "You see, what the problem is your femur's too long." And I kind of was listening. I was like, right, he's going to say something else. He's going to say something magical now. And he walked away. I'm just like, holy shit. What all this woman can do is take out a hacksaw and cut bits of femur off. Like, you know, if I go and tell you that your personality is this, how does that help you develop and grow? And the answer is, like, it doesn't. So the process is, what would be the behaviors that you want from people? So there is research on this, and I can't remember them because there's 10 of them, but there's 10 qualities that have been identified, called the PCDEs, the psychological characteristics for development excellence. But they sound like goal setting, imagery, self-regulation, quality evaluations, quality practice, you know, the ability to understand what behaviors look like in these areas, the ability to focus, set goals, and setting goals also includes setting rewards for achieving goals. You know, so there's that kind of list of like psychological qualities, and you'd ask yourself what helps in there in terms of an injury and coping with something. It's probably going to be somebody who doesn't ascribe their self-worth to their performance. Somebody who actually ascribes what they do to their enjoyment means that they're more likely going to last and get through a bit of a difficulty. One of the things that I routinely see with elite athletes is a sense of perfectionism and a sense of it's too important, and it can actually hamper their ability to cope with demands. It's like a double-edged sword. It's so important that they put everything in, but it's so important that they stress out about it to an extent that it holds them back. It's a very fine balance. But one of the things that I do with athletes is I'll say, right, I want you to draw out your shape of you as a human, like just draw out a stick person or whatever, but in 3D, so there's space in the middle, you know, like a toilet sign. And then I say, right, we're going to describe you, start describing you. You've got blue eyes. You're 6 foot. You've got size 11 feet. Your best back squat is 120. Your best front squat is 100. Okay, you know, you keep going through this, and then you say after 5-10 minutes, okay, have we fully described you? No. Right. How long would we do this until we fully describe you? And they say, well, you know, maybe an hour, maybe a day, you know. And actually, it's not possible to fully describe you, because every day you change, every experience changes you and is a new thing we could add in there. So it's not possible for us to describe you with one thing. And this injury that you're facing, the setback that you're facing, or the lack of performance you're experiencing doesn't fully describe you. Yet you're stressed out about it because you're transferring that one thing into a big, massive thing of your identity. Do you see what I've done there? Mm-hmm. And I'll explain it to you this way. Have you ever eaten a pizza, Josh?
Oh, yeah, I love pizza.
Right. I want you to imagine you're walking down the street and, you know, you see a bit of pepperoni, the meat, on the ground, right? You see you see the pepperoni on the ground, and you look at it and you go, there's a bit of pepperoni. When you go down to the pizza shop, you don't look at the pizza and go, there's a bit of pepperoni. You go, there's a bit of pizza. You don't overgeneralize the ingredient to be the substance of the whole. So that's the big issue when it comes to rehab, is we need to take away the idea that this performance, this sport, is being overgeneralized to our whole identity. It's one aspect of it. It's not the whole thing. And that'll reduce stress and allow us to hopefully cope better and be less stressed out about it and make better decisions in terms of the rehab.
I think that's, and that is something that I've heard, you know, being around, and I'm not trying to overgeneralize myself. I'm just providing a little context, but I've heard that in like a rehab environment where the physio or the physical therapist will refer to someone as like an ACL or like as their injury, like, oh, that person's a this or that person's a that. And it's like, well, the person's the person and they're experiencing something. I think it's interesting how that kind of bleeds through a lot of different professions. And I'd like to switch gears just a little bit, because we've talked a lot about a lot of this from the athlete's perspective, but what about from the coach's perspective, the person who is overseeing all of this and seeing this across 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 people, and then dealing with, you know, because we're talking about on the scale of one, these things persist. This is how you can address, you know, competition or a very anxiety provoking situation. This is how you can manage training. This is how you can manage injury. But then what about the person who's overseeing a large group of people going through all of this? I'm sure they can take on a lot of responsibility and a lot of the stress and try and carry the weight of that.
Let's not beat up around the bush here. You know, you're sat here doing a podcast, you're on weightlifting, and you're also doing a master's, or have you done the master's in strength and condition? And
I'm in the process, yeah.
Yeah, and you're a coach in a weightlifting club. You know, are you telling me that your identity is not fully taken up? You know, what else have you got on the side there? Like, you know, you play a little bit of chess maybe? Is that the only other thing? So, like, you know, and it's typical, right? Passionate people, you know, display high levels of passion, and that's great. But it's difficult whenever we get a downer of things don't go well, you know, that's our entire identity. That's what we've pinned everything on. You know, like, I once, I'm going to say this, and it's like, okay, I'm going to say it. There was a guy I met, and he had a crap tattoo of a barbell. And like, you know, wasn't like very impressive in his, he came to a coaching course, that I was running, and, you know, he loved the sport and he was very passionate about it and everything else, but like hadn't really invested much time in it. It was like, I've got a barbell tattoo and now I've got my level one coaching certificate. And then I see the blog post that he's put up, and it's kind of about, like, you know, talking about his, why he's not, like, you know, the world's best coach because he hasn't had this luck and all this sort of stuff. And I just thought, dude, like, you know, you're not going to be a millionaire. You're not going to, most people are not going to be full-time weightlifting coaches in their life. They need something else. They need a job. They need other passions and hobbies. You know, this isn't it. And I see that, like, in coaches as much as I see it in athletes. Like, this isn't it. It is part of it, but it's not all of it. So you need to develop your identity in a broader way to able to cope. A good way to think of this is, like, if you've got a ship and you put in one anchor, it'll, you know, that's all right. But if something goes wrong, then it's not held down in the storm. If you put in five anchors, then it's more likely going to be held down in the storm. And if you look at your Instagram, and I know nobody's Instagram is real, but if you look at your Instagram and all your posts are about lifting, like, is that really all your identity? Is that all you are? Do you have no other parts of your identity, like friends, family, you know, cooking, what dogs? I don't know. What else? What else are you? So I get athletes actually look at their Instagrams and say the personal ones, not the public ones they put out. But I'd say, like, you know, categorize these into identities. What are your anchors here? And they'll say, well, these three posts are all about that topic. That's one anchor. It's like, right, okay, now we've got a bigger idea of who you are and what's important to you. And then suddenly things are less stressful when they go wrong. But if all you have is one anchor and you get injured or you get a setback or your business isn't going well or your coaching business isn't going well, your weightlifting club's not going well, then suddenly it becomes very stressful. So I think the same applies to athletes as coaches there.
And then what would your take on the fact that, so these social media platforms, they're almost hard to describe, but it's like a situation where you're projecting what you do and who you are into a large group of people who have like a very fleeting interest. And I'll interact with people who have developed really large followings because it drives business or that's like a lot of their, maybe they get a lot of satisfaction from it, but you hear that they maybe put up a post and it's like, oh, this didn't get a lot of engagement, therefore it's not what people want to see, therefore I won't post about it, right? So a lot of the engagement is what drives the content. The content is kind of secondary to the engagement, or they're like inextricably linked.
Yeah.
So how do you navigate this world where everyone else dictates who you are and what you are, and then who you are and what you are dictates who engages with it?
Do you know, I feel as if I should open a beer right now if I'm going to answer that question. I'm like, right, I'm on my soapbox. I'm going to take down social media. Then we're going to sort the world out. But in a serious note, like what you've actually highlighted there is if you think about what causes a stress, if I look at this from a philosophical point of view of other people must like my post, other people must approve of me. Or I must be approved of by other people. Suddenly then that means like, here, I'm your dancing clown and I'm going to dance and make noise until I find the noise and dance that you like, and then I'm going to keep dancing. And like, that is classical conditioning. It's like what Skinner did to the pigeons is like, you know, rewarded them and then they developed crazy behaviors in line with the rewards that they were getting. So I would say, like, you know, have you lost your identity to the crowd? If that's what you're doing, if you're driving engagement. Now, I understand if you're running a professional account and you're trying to drive business and awareness, but I'd like to think that whatever you're doing as a professional is driven by some sort of understanding of like what does the customer need. And I think, you know, a marketing expert called Seth Godin, he said, nobody buys drill bits because they want a drill bit. They buy drill bits because they want a hole, you know? And if we think of weightlifting, like why do people want weightlifting? They want it because they either want to see strong people doing strong things that are cool, or they want to get strong themselves, or they want to get some speed, or, you know, or maybe they just like to wear singlets. I don't know. But like, what's the need? So again, like if you're letting other people drive what you post, you're being controlled by the masses, and you know it's time to sort of take a look at what is it you're trying to achieve in the long term. I'm notoriously bad at social media, and partly because like in the start I started telling people how stupid they were when they were doing stupid things, and then because like you know we're of the generation that grew up and learned how to act on social media, and then I've realized that actually doesn't work from a psychology perspective. Like my opinion, me giving my opinion doesn't change somebody else's behavior. So like I now only post on social media myself if it's to do with something to do with psychology that's part of my business or brand. So I think if it's aligned that way, that's fine. But I mean, there's people who have to post because they're posting and then sort of like equating whether or not they're actually doing the training with how many posts they're doing. You know, it shouldn't be for other people. It should be for ourselves. I don't know, Josh, like you tell me, you're probably more of an expert in social media than me. Like what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think it's really funny actually that you mentioned that because I interviewed, Aaron Cunanan, who is a researcher and he works at the UFC Performance Institute, but he did some work on basically like barbell trajectory and kind of the implications on a successful or unsuccessful lift in a sample of you know, really elite level lifters. We're talking Pan Ams and Worlds. And I mentioned this during the podcast that I did a couple technique posts, which basically took a paper by Shyam Chavda, and they detailed the technique, like where the shoulder should be, where the hip should be, how the pull should look, things that would influence that. And I made it into a couple, like, you know, very plain infographics. I'm like, oh, this is great. This is basically like technique 101. And it got like 44 likes. And then I'll put a post up of me like lifting weights, like, oh, look, I hit a cool PR, and it's like 400. and I just think to myself, like, something that has this much value is completely, I don't know, like, people just don't really care for it. And then I'll just have me as a person lifting, and then it gets a lot more interaction. So what I've tried to do is like make those two things somewhat compatible, where I'll put up a lift and say, hey, this is kind of my decision making, or this is what I focused on, or this is what I'm trying to do now, or what seemed to help. So I try to bridge what I think people want and what they need. Or maybe it's like, I don't know, maybe it's definitely tricky to navigate. Yeah. And I don't care to navigate it as much. but you know, it's kind of like you said, you've got to do your best to support your business and your brand.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the other thing is that you have a responsibility if you're running a business, or if you're just promoting sport, you have a responsibility to market it well, to do a good job. And that might mean, you know, a nice little dainty post with you in your singlet. You know, but at the same time, it's how can you like tie in the here's my PR and I did it because I followed this technique, and this was an awesome bit of knowledge, and share the knowledge, you know. So we do have a responsibility to not clickbait people in, but like legit bait people in, where it's like, here's a legit thing, and get them in and get them attracted to it, and then try and give them information. But I just think there's so many people out there whose Instagrams are literally just, you know, it's like clickbait for weightlifting or clickbait for sport or whatever. It's like, how can I do a post that's going to get likes? It's not actually making the world a better place.
Well, then social media, and I actually like how this segued. Social media has done a lot for exposing the good, and then it's done probably more for exposing the bad, or exposing the pseudo experts, if we want to call them that. So I see this a lot with, you know, I'm not an expert in nutrition by any means. I know maybe a little bit, maybe a passing amount, depending on whose criteria we're using. But I see a lot of nutrition information and then training information, etc., that I don't know what it's founded on. It's founded on preference and appeal versus specificity, overload, variation. So in the psychological realm, I'm sure I don't know if you consume enough social media to see if there's like pseudo psychology experts kind of trying to spread information about mindset and toughness and mental health and all of that. What do you think? This is a big question. What do you think social media gets wrong when they're talking about the psychological side of things? And we can maybe keep this a bit more specific to athletics. I know you wrote a post, and it might have been on your LinkedIn, but it's like mental toughness as a fruit salad, or as a fruit salad or something. So maybe that's a good segue. But what are some topics that people get wrong on social media?
So I think the biggest thing is that when we say, oh, you know, in the 80% Metal podcast with Pete that I do, Pete once said to me, oh yeah, the reason that happens is because of the internet. And I very sharply turned around and said, you're telling me that a bunch of wires that conduct electricity cause something to happen? And he kind of got me and was like, yeah, mate, it's not the internet, it's not social media, it's people. And I think when we use the term like social media does this, social media, it's not, it's people. And we need to put, because that makes the problem solvable. That makes us understand it. It's not just social media, it's people. And this would be happening if everyone was sat around in a bar or at a competition. People would be talking shit and coming up with shit ideas and promoting shit things. Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah. Cool. Swear all you want. And I really want to come on the back end of that and say, I was actually listening to my favorite podcast, my second favorite behind 80% Mental. It's called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And they were talking about conspiracy theories and how it's been, you know, over the last 100 years, these ideas of conspiratorial thinking and conspiracy theories and pseudoscience and pseudo information, it's been rampant. Like it hasn't really changed much. It's just the way things have been. When you have a brain that can think and think incorrectly, you're going to get incorrect information and incorrectly by, you know, I guess by the definition of not following the line of like factual information or a line of like logical reasoning. So go ahead,
well,
continue.
You know, that you're spot on. Like, this isn't a new feature and we've been doing it lots. So to go back to that, social media is not the problem. Humans are the problem. And it comes down to the issue of like what attracts humans is like the horror stories and negativity stuff is the big sort of like red flags, because we're biased to be wary of things that are dangerous or things that are dramatic, because those are the things that are going to be important for our survival. It's much more difficult to actually talk about like what's the context of this and how does this help me improve, because that's something I have to be really actively looking at. What I want is something that's quick and nasty and says, look out, there's a tiger over there, or look out, doing the catapult versus the triple extension argument is, you know, dangerous or whatever, or RDLs are dangerous, or like, what is it? John North, this is Superman pool, is better than the catapult. Like, everyone's like, oh no, there's something wrong, because, and that it gets their attention. So I think the thing is for me is like, humans going to be attracted to that clickbaity, like there's something wrong thing. And you as an individual have to go like, where does this overlap with the truth, and where does this overlap with other things? And you have to critically evaluate it. And you know yourself, Josh, is like, from a science background, we have to try and falsify things, not prove them right. Because I can prove that I'm the world's best psychologist. I'm not even the world's best psychologist in my own flipping house, believe it or not. I'm literally, I have to be in a room by myself in my house because my partner's actually an academic researcher. He knows a hell of a lot. So the thing about this is we can prove ourselves to be something amazing or have some amazing bit of knowledge, and we like that. But very rarely will we go, look, I'm wrong and I don't have the right idea, because that's a difficult thing to do. So we have to try and falsify things. It's Popperian approach to science, but we should do it with facts. I feel as if there was so much more I should have said there, because we did talk, like that was a big intro into that topic, and I do want to say more, but my head's just gone a bit off.
No. I'll just put a quick comment. You actually talked about catapult and triple extension, and I remember when I was first looking for weightlifting coaching, I reached out to Columbus Weightlifting. That's a local club in Columbus, Columbus, Ohio. And one of the first questions I had was, do you teach the catapult method or do you teach triple extension? And I was like, well, if you teach triple extension, I don't want any part of it, because, you know, John North and Don McCauley say that I should use the catapult method. Looking back on that, makes no sense as a line of inquiry for finding the right coach, because like force is force, force application is force application. We're trying to get the bar above our heads. Like, how can you do that best? And usually this is like the set of constraints we can operate under, but it's not like a method. It's just like, what is most efficient? You're going to do the thing that's most efficient. And that's pretty simple when you actually come to terms with it. But, you know, piggybacking off of that idea of social media, I think that was a good lead in. It's like, hey, social media is not the problem. It's the people espousing this information. You have to think about it critically. But I think the hard part is that's implying that we have some sort of filter. And, you know, when you try to follow psychology experts, nutrition experts, coaching experts, you kind of spread yourself thin in terms of what you know, and you have to rely on the person, right? You have to rely on their honesty. You have to rely on their transparency. Sometimes they maybe even convince themselves that they're spreading the truth, or they're even fighting all of these myths. Because what's funny is when I follow like Spencer Nadolski and a couple other physicians, and they'll share posts of people saying, hey, the doctors don't want you to know this. Your doctor is getting it wrong. So there are so many layers to actually finding what's right. And I think that's what's tough to navigate, is it's not even that, you know, you just say, hey, this group of people, they don't have the correct information. It's they're saying that we don't have the correct information. Now we're getting backlash from a group that's founded on pseudoscience.
So, yeah, I remember now you had mentioned about the mental toughness article that I wrote. Mm-hmm. So I want to just hit you on this point about the catapult versus Superman pull versus triple extension versus, you know, three backflips and a cup of tea. Right. People say, oh yeah, knees out, you know, whenever you're squatting, right? What does that actually mean? Like nobody's going to argue with me that's a shit cue, you know, knees have to be in, right? But that's a shit cue, because how far out? Because if I put my kneecaps, you know, 6 meters apart, I've suddenly got a knee injury. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it's a specificity of the language. And I think this is the problem when people argue about coaching points and ideas, is that they lose what they mean by not having specificity of language. So we say knees out. What do we mean by that? How far out do my knees need to be? Because too far out and I've got a dislocated knee. Do you know what I mean? Same issue in psychology is that people will say, okay, people shouldn't worry and you should just tell people that they don't need to worry about it. It's not important. Okay, that's good advice, because, you know, weightlifting for a large part of us isn't important enough that we should lose sleep over it. I think that's fairly, you know, useful to say that. For most people, there's no benefit losing sleep over weightlifting. But if somebody is stressed out, and I walk up and I say, oh yeah, don't lose any sleep over it, it's not that important. What I've done is I've minimized their experience. I've told them not to worry about it, and I've given them no helpful advice. The thing I've said is factually correct, but is ultimately completely unhelpful. And that's the difference between being right and being helpful in the process of developing ourselves. When it comes to psychology, there is a massive amount of misinformation out there. And one of the things that does concern me is there seems to be an ever-growing guruship of people who are highly qualified in one area, stepping over into another area and giving opinions on psychology. And I think, like, I nearly have my UKSCA qualification. I'm one bit of stuff away from it, or one assessment away from it. But I'm never going to be an S&C coach. I'm never going to be somebody who has an adequate, you know, understanding of eccentric utilization ratio and the difference between that and the dynamic strength index, and what's the reactive strength index and what the difference is in these different tests and measures. You know, I'm not an expert in that area. I have a basic understanding, and I stop myself speaking about those things. I think there's an easiness when it comes to psychology to fool ourselves into thinking that we know what things are about. And people will talk about mental toughness. Mental toughness is like a buzzword and a catch-all thing. And within psychology, people will say mental toughness. But I don't know, what do you think mental toughness is? If I was to ask you what that means, Josh, just what's your gut reaction there in weightlifting? What's a mentally tough weightlifter?